Good morning, devoted session assembly. And welcome to those arriving. In this celebration of Buddha's great awakening, we call Rohatsu Sesshin. As the Shuso said last night, it's good to be kind to our mind in Sesshin and all the time. There might be some delusions that arise in our mind. There might be some thoughts of self-concern and emotions of distress. These are beings. One of my teacher, Tenshin Roshi's, I think kind of unusual teachings is that these thoughts and emotions and experiences happening to us are sentient beings. We vow to save them. Which means we can be kind to these beings that arise in our mind. Kind and compassionate to them, meaning like we can empathize with their suffering and wish for them to be free of their suffering, and we can even vow to save them, to liberate them from their suffering and cross them over to the other shore of freedom. Which of course starts with being very, very kind and gentle with any experience that arises for us. Can't go wrong with that. Having said that, that is one of the Buddha's great teachings, I think. The Buddha didn't always know about this teaching. It took a Buddha a little while to discover it. The middle way is kind to all experiences, kind to ourselves and kind to others. So because this is the celebration of Buddha's great awakening, we open the scripture, that the old story that all the different Buddhist traditions take as scripture, the Buddha's story of his own awakening in his own words. Brief recap for those just arriving. The Buddha left home in search of the unborn, the unailing, the unaging, the deathless. And went and found some spiritual teachers and learned a lot from them, different types of meditation, but felt like there may be more. And then he went off by himself and started engaging in these ascetic practices to see if they might be the path to awakening. And so we've heard over a couple of days these extreme practices that sound like the Buddha's not being very kind to himself. We might say that it was in the name of this deeper kindness that he really felt like, I have to get to the bottom of the matter for the benefit of myself and all beings. He's a little bit rough about it. And later, you realize it's not so helpful to be so rough with oneself. But at this point, after all these pranayama, breathing exercises that were very, very painful to his head and to his belly and his whole body, very painful for a long time, the Buddha says, I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food, then the deities, the devas, came to me and said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do so, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and this will sustain you. Almost like these protectors around the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, knowing that he better not die before he completes this work, because this is the time for a Buddha to appear in the world. And so if you don't eat it all, we're going to inject sweet dew into your pores, heavenly nectar. So the Buddha says, I considered, well, if I claim to be completely fasting while these deities infuse heavenly food into the pores of my skin and this sustains me, then I shall be lying. I wouldn't really be fasting. So I can't completely fast here because the deities won't let me. So I dismissed those deities saying, don't bother. It's kind of interesting little piece of the story. So I thought, I can't get away with eating nothing. I thought, suppose I just take very little food, a handful each time, whether a bean soup or lentil soup or vetch soup or pea soup. So I took very little food, a handful each time, whether bean soup, lentil soup, or vetch soup or pea soup. While I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green, bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone, and if I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I defecated or urinated, I fell over on my face there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. Now when people saw me, some said, the ascetic Gotama is black. Other people said, the ascetic Gotama is not black, he's brown. Other people said, the ascetic Gotama is neither black nor brown, he's golden skinned. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. I thought, whatever ascetics or Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There's none beyond this. And whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion. This is the utmost. There's none beyond this. And whatever ascetics and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, and piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There's none beyond this. But by this racking, painful practice of austerities, I have not attained any supramundane distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment? A doubt arises in the Bodhisattva's mind. Maybe all this painful self-mortification is not actually working. Could there be another path? He had to try it, it seems like. He had to try everything. Which maybe had the advantage of later no doubts will arise about other methods. Say, well, Buddha, you could go further than this if you just practice this pranayama or this fasting. Buddha's like, could say, no, actually, I already checked that out. Thank you very much. So we're exploring in the Sesshin the issue of enlightenment, awakening, and in particular its relationship to delusion through the teachings of Dogen Zenji. In the early Buddhist teachings, delusion and enlightenment, awakening, were like polar opposites. One is the elimination of the other, and one is the elimination of the other. Samsara is the realm of delusion, the often translated as cyclic existence, the cycle of birth and old age, sickness and death, and birth and death, and birth and death, and birth and death. We could even look at it just in one day, we're cycling through these same habit patterns over and over again, stuck in endless loops of habitual patterns. Painful delusion. And nirvana is the end of birth and death, the end of this cycle of habitual stuckness. So samsara and nirvana are two other terms we could roughly speak of as delusion and awakening. And as far as their relationship goes, this has been an issue through the whole history of Buddha Dharma. And one resolution or radical statement, famous statement about their relationship was one of the great Bodhisattva Nagarjuna in about the 2nd century of the Common Era, who, after many chapters of exploring how because this depends on this, we can't really have this without this, and so nothing really exists on its own. Nagarjuna's middle way verses almost kind of culminates near the end with this surprising statement in verse 19 of chapter 25 of the middle way verses. Nagarjuna says, There's not the slightest difference between samsara and nirvana. There's not the slightest difference between nirvana and samsara. So that's kind of a Indian non-duality before the Zen thing emerges on the scene. How can we understand this? One of the great sayings from way back from my teacher Tenzin Roshi, talking about these two terms, samsara and nirvana, defining them, really. He once said, nirvana is simply not meddling with samsara. And samsara is simply meddling with nirvana. That might be a nice commentary on Nagarjuna's verse. I also back there practicing with him at Tassajara in the old days. I think once we were asked in a practice period, everybody to write some haiku. One haiku about delusion and one about awakening. I think it's something like this. So yeah, this is related to our topic this week. Haiku is, you know, there's probably certain stylistic things about official Japanese haiku, or what type of imagery to use in each line and so on. But the basic, I think, exercise here is just try to keep this the form of five-syllable line, seven-syllable line, five-syllable line. So that's these two haiku. Delusion and awakening that I wrote. A backseat driver trying in vain to control this car with no brakes. And the follow-up haiku. A backseat driver vowing to settle back down and enjoy the ride. Maybe this is something to do with Dogen's exploration of how is it when a person of great realization returns to delusion. Can they still be a backseat driver? Another point we've been looking at a little bit this session is practice and verification. One of Dogen's great teachings is shusho funi. Practice and verification are not two, or non-dual. And if practice and realization were two things, as it appears to an ordinary person, each could be recognized separately. But it's not like this. One moment of practice is one moment of verification or confirmation. And they're simultaneous. It's not that practice leads up to some future verification. almost like one of the main slogans of Soto Zen, I think. And so one way to understand this would be this is nice teaching by Ajahn Chah, who was a Theravada teacher of our time, and he said, if you let go a little, you have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you have complete peace and freedom, and your struggles with the world have come to an end. So I think we could apply shusho funi to this statement, that if you let go a little, that's a practice. You can, holding on to some thought, some idea, some bodily tension, let go just a little. And you have a little peace. The peace is the verification. There's confirmation of peace right at the moment of letting go. It doesn't come later, right? It's a verification of a little peace. Nirvana is sometimes called peace. Maybe it's a little nirvana with a little letting go. And if you let go a lot, there's a confirmation of a lot of peace. Does that make sense? That one, there's a practice and a verification. They're almost the same, but one's something that we can kind of like intentionally let go. And then we could call it a result of peace, but the result's right there in the letting go. The peace is right there at the same time. Practicing verification or non-dual. And we could apply it to all other types of practice and realization, many different types of practice and realization. That's the kind of simple one to talk about, right? We could also practice investigating through meditative inquiry, does this present awareness arise and cease? Or does it have any boundaries? And then in that practice of investigation, we might verify that the eternal nature of awareness and the boundless nature of awareness, right there at the moment of the inquiry, the verification could arise. So it's not like there's only one kind of practice and one kind of verification, but whenever there's practice, there's verification at that moment, I think is what Dogen's saying, true practice. We've also been talking about this line of Dogen in his great awakening essay. He said, it's not that that great awakening is not being deluded. It's one of his lines in his essay called Daigo. It's not the great awakening is not being deluded. In other words, great awakening does not mean not being deluded. And then very similar to this line in the Genjo Koan of Dogen, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. And sometimes things like that might sound so different from the Buddha's early teachings, but it occurred to me, this actually sounds quite similar to the Buddha's very first teaching that we chant here in the Zendo sometimes, setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, and which is another version of the Buddha's awakening, kind of description of the content of his awakening, these Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha says in that sutra, this suffering, which is kind of related to delusion in a way, right? This discontent, you could say the discontent's kind of based on delusion. They're kind of woven together, dukkha and delusion, right? But the Buddha says this suffering, this discontent, must be fully understood. That's the kind of practice around suffering. There is this truth of suffering. This suffering must be fully understood. That's a kind of practice we can do with suffering. And the Buddha's awakening was, this suffering has been fully understood. Such was the vision, the knowledge, the wisdom, the awareness, the light that arose in me with regard to things not heard before. So this simple statement, this suffering as a noble truth has been fully understood, I think is quite similar to those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Isn't it kind of similar? There's some correlation there. Yeah? It's kind of like understanding what suffering is. There's other noble truths there. This cessation of suffering, the Buddha says, must be realized. This cessation of suffering has been realized. That's a little bit different. Almost like the flip side of the same understanding, flip side of the same enlightenment. But Buddha starts with saying, this suffering has been fully understood. I have great understanding about this suffering. That's a vision and a knowledge and a wisdom. There's great realization about what suffering is and what delusion is. We study delusion to understand it fully. Now we have this story that Dogen's bringing up in this essay we're looking at called Daigo, or Great Awakening. Go is also pronounced Satori, Great Satori. Dogen is exploring, and he brings up this story from old China where a monk asks this teacher named various things, including Xu Jing. He asks, how is it when a person of great realization, a person of great satori, returns to delusion? And the teacher says, a broken mirror never reflects again. Fallen flowers can never climb back up on the tree. And kind of a strange way to put it, but we could understand this as this mirror that we're talking about is a kind of dualistic mirror, a mirror of consciousness, but that's reflecting things separately from itself. The kind of like the reflections in the mirror are not quite reality. They're like, once removed, their reflections are different from the reality. That's the kind of mirror here that gets broken for a greatly awakened one. Also, we could maybe say in Zen, we have those stories about like, we gotta constantly polish the mirror so that no dust lands on it. And like, it's some kind of like consciousness that we have to keep, we have to keep clear because it keeps getting defiled. This kind, we could also see it as that kind of mirror, the kind of mirror that can keep getting defiled by dust. that mirror gets shattered. Like the sixth ancestor says, there's not really a mirror like that that gets defiled by dust. So kind of a poetic way of saying, a greatly awakened one, their dualistic perception, their mirroring perception is shattered, and there's just one. There's just one left. And the flowers could be seen as like nice looking habits and decorations on our original face that aren't really needed, and they kind of hinder us. So they anything extra drops away. When the flowers have dropped off, it's like the extra flowers of the non-essential have dropped off this tree, and the tree is just just bare suchness, exposed in the golden wind of winter. So that's this poetic image of how is it when a greatly awakened one returns to delusion? Well, the broken mirror never shines again. They never go back to dualistic perception. And the fallen flowers never climb back up on the tree. All the dropped away extra stuff doesn't start like creeping back in and defile the awakened one again. It seems to be that's the kind of gist of the original story. But as usual, Dogen likes to take a story and look at it in all new ways. And if there's any duality in the story, Dogen will be sure to find it and reveal it and drop it away. So you might find a little duality in that story, right? That sounds like this person, it kind of sounds like the person is completely changed forever and they don't go back. Like we're talking about irreversibility, which is part of the Indian understanding of these stages of enlightenment are irreversible. But I think Dogen's not pointing it to irreversibility here. He's pointing at something beyond. Irreversibility would be like, there's this deluded state, and then there's this awakened state, and this one doesn't go back to that one. It's a little too clunky, maybe, for Dogen. Yes.
The image of the flowers falling in the bigger tree seems to come from a poetics that's familiar with a landscape where the trees do shed their leaves in there, and I've often thought, oh, they're so beautiful in that bare form.
Mm-hmm.
There's some intimacy where you really see them.
It's true. That's a nice point. Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Mm-hmm. The leaves and flowers kind of hide the true nakedness, naked suchness of the tree, which is really magnificent. Yeah, nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the awakened one is no longer hidden by those extra flowers. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And is really angry at something in my life. Mm-hmm. How come it's not that vision of awakening that then...
Yeah, that we almost interpret the poetic image the opposite way, right? like the awakened person's pure mirror is broken, right? And their pure flowers have fallen. Yeah. It's interesting because the image can be heard that way, right? When I first heard that, that's kind of where I went with it too. Although we would then have the question of, what about this never again business? It's kind of like, then they're deluded forever. Like they'll never be awakened again. That would maybe be a problem with seeing it that way. Because the broken mirror never can shine again. It's broken forever. That sounds like a little too much, right? For one little anger, right? And the flowers can never go back on the tree. There'll never be any more awakening. And it might be just that, like the Zen people, definitely Dogen likes to sort of say things that the first response is to kind of resonate with it one way, but as we look deeper, we see he's saying the other thing, just to keep our mind very flexible. It could be like that. But I thought, yeah, if I was trying to talk about that image of irreversibility, I might not choose those metaphors. They are kind of funny, I think. But there are, in the Blue Cliff Record, there's a line about, smash the mirror and I'll meet you there. Which is kind of talking about, actually the mirror is what's actually, blocking us from meeting as completely one. And, in Dogen's, essay called The Ancient Mirror, we looked at some years ago here, there's, a story about two Zen practitioners talking about, the ancient mirror. I have an ancient mirror, and when a foreigner comes, the foreigner is reflected, and when a native person comes, the native person is reflected. And in other words, it doesn't discriminate. Everything's reflected without discrimination. And the other says to him, well, what if another mirror comes and meets you? And he says, then nothing's reflected. And the other, his friend says, that's not how I would say it. And well, how would you say it? I would say that shattered into 100 pieces. So there's another image of like the mirror shattered is a positive thing about that. No reflecting of reflecting of reflecting anymore, but just one suchness. So mirrors get used in different ways in Zen. Also related to this returning to delusion issue, we have that kind of famous Zen saying one of the ancestors said, before I started practicing, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. And after practicing for a while, then mountains were no longer mountains and rivers were no longer rivers. But after practicing even longer, these days mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers again. So is that like a greatly awakened one returning to delusion? Are the mountains at the end of all that practice, the mountains and rivers, are they the same as the first mountains and rivers? Or not, right? Maybe not. Now they're, it's the same world that we used to call delusion, but exactly the same world. But maybe it's understood slightly differently.
Different eyeball.
So this might be something to keep in mind while we're exploring. What's it like when a greatly awakened one returns to delusion? Is it the same delusion that they started in or not? So, So Dogen brings up this story about what's it like when a really awakened one returns to delusion. In Dogen's extensive record, the Eihei Koroku, he also brings up the same story. He quotes the, what's it like when a greatly awakened one returns to delusion? A broken mirror never shines again, fallen flowers never climb back up onto the tree. And then Dogen says, if someone were to ask me, how is it when a person of great awakening returns to delusion? I would say, if the great ocean knew it was full, the hundreds of rivers would flow upstream or backwards. Yeah. Almost like every line of these ancestors sometimes you can really sit with. We call them the koans, right? So I think it's an interesting one. And maybe related to Dogen's, those who have great delusion about realization are sentient beings. In other words, those who have all these ideas about great awakening are just ordinary sentient beings, as opposed to those who have great realization of delusion, those are Buddhas. So it's a little like that, maybe, in that the great ocean is full, right? The great ocean is so full and vast, and it's just endlessly receives all of these flowing rivers. It's just, everything is coming forward and confirming the ocean, making the ocean, and though it's already full, infinite rivers can flow into it. But if the ocean knew that it was full, like, I am such a full ocean, then it actually might start resisting all those rivers flowing into it, and they would start actually start pushing them backwards, and they start flowing upstream backwards. They'd run away from the ocean, yeah. So it's not that the ocean's not full, but as Dogen said, if the great ocean knew that it was full, then the hundreds of rivers would start flowing backwards. Yeah. That's right, there'd be no room for them. But if it doesn't know it's full, then it's so receptive, anything can flow into it. It's willing to receive all the rivers, and there's room, infinite room. But as soon as it's like, and the strange thing, it seems to me, is maybe the ocean really is full already, but miraculously the rivers can still flow into it. But as soon as it starts thinking it's full, that's like a person of great realization returning to delusion. So that's a little like, you know, another riff on the story from Dogen's other record. Now we're back to Shogogenzo Daigo, great Satori. We're exploring this story about how it is when a person of great awakening returns to delusion. Dogen says, we should work at this a bit. He's going to make us work at it a bit. Is the return to delusion of the person of great awakening the equivalent of a person without awakening? He asks. When the person of great awakening returns to delusion, does he take up his great awakening and make it into delusion? I think he's asking all these questions, and I think probably the answer is no to all of these. Does she return to delusion by taking up delusion from somewhere else and covering it over her great awakening? Nah. Again, does the person of great awakening, although remaining himself without destroying his great awakening, go on to study returning to delusion. That sounds a little better, but it's still separating great awakening and returning to delusion. Or does returning to delusion of the person of great awakening refer to taking up a further great awakening as returning to delusion? We should study it in these various ways. Again, is great awakening one hand and returning to delusion the other hand? Or is it like great awakening is like five fingers and returning to delusion is a hand? However we take them, we should recognize that hearing that the person of great awakening returns to delusion is the complete mastery of our study. We should recognize that there is a great awakening that makes returning to delusion an intimate experience. The 17th, 18th century Soto Zen scholar, practitioner, Menzan, one of the great Soto ancestors from more recent times, commenting on this essay of Dogen, said, "Returning to delusion is the collapsing together of great awakening with non-awakening to make a single bundle." Yes.
I was going to say something in a very clunky, awkward way that sounds very much like what you just said in a graceful, understandable way.
Well, Menzan said it.
Okay, Menzan.
These teachings are not, you know, completely unheard of before, like Nagarjuna's samsara and nirvana. There's not the slightest distinction between them. And we have this also term that goes back even further. I think it's from the Mahayana Sutras, apratishtita nirvana, which means like non-abiding nirvana. It's definitely a Mahayana term. And non-abiding nirvana means not abiding in the cessation of birth and death, but also not abiding in this, in samsara, the cycle of birth and death. It doesn't abide in either side. It doesn't abide anywhere.
Well, it sounds like that is the bodhisattva path and commitment.
That's the bodhisattva path and commitment. Not abiding in a removed nirvana that doesn't see any birth and death, and the bodhisattva is willing to live in the appearance of birth and death to benefit born, dying beings. So I think that is the meaning of non-abiding nirvana. Is it's a Mahayana term for the bodhisattva vow that does realize the emptiness of birth and death, but doesn't abide there. And also doesn't abide in wallowing around in birth and death. Yes, Ziggy?
You just used a word that I was thinking about, willingness.
Willingness.
I think it's such a powerful word, to be willing to show up wherever, if it's the nirvana or the samsara, where it's just that. And it's a moving, always changing dynamic.
Yes. Yes.
And I think where I can suffer is in the unwillingness to either not want to leave the nirvana or not want to stay in the samsara. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that kind of inability to see that each is contained in both.
Yeah, and that's a profound willingness, right? And a challenging willingness. And And it's easy to kind of lean one way or the other. Of course, most of us are leaning pretty heavily into the samsara side.
Yeah, right. But for the nirvana side, mm-hmm. even wanting not to recognize that the not wanting to stay there is a form of samsara.
Yes, that's right. Wanting to abide in nirvana is a form of samsara.
Yeah. So it's a form of samsara. So mm-hmm. it's this willingness to abide completely where you are.
Total flexibility. There's that great story where a monk asked Jiaozhou, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" And sometimes Jiaozhou more famously says, "No," and that's a whole other story. But one time Jiaozhou said, "Yes." No, dogs have Buddha nature. Animals have Buddha nature. And then the monk asked, "Well, if the dog has Buddha nature, then why does it enter into this bag of skin? This like creature of dog?" And Jiaozhou says, "It knowingly and willingly transgresses its pure Buddha nature radiance and to be a dog." So that when we say it willingly, Buddha nature willingly manifests as a dog, knowingly and willingly. Buddha nature knowingly and willingly transgresses. We can say that.
Yes. It just made me think of that one moment, and I think it was that awakening moment for St. Francis when he kissed the leper. You know, there was this, it became nirvana for him. He did nothing for so much of his life. They were like an intention. And then there was that great act of that intimacy with that which was so
Wonderful. Flowering of equanimity. Sounds like it, yes. Mm-hmm. Equanimity, perfect equanimity. Yeah. Yes, Michael. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the ox herding. Yeah, catching a glimpse of the ox, catching the ox, taming the ox, riding the ox, no ox. And then there's returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. Yeah, yeah, totally ordinary. Totally, totally related.
And where is that story from?
It's a Chinese Zen teaching of these kind of stages, 10 stages of enlightenment in Zen. Interestingly, ending with just being in the marketplace and ordinariness. The Zen ending stage is total ordinariness, and whereas the kind of earlier Buddhist model is like the end stage is total extraordinariness. Yeah. Yeah, so that's all related. That's before Dogen, that's in China, yeah. Rusted.
I would like to say thank you for the reminder that occasional moments of bodhisattvic reluctance are not separate from the die Buddha nature level of profound, all-encompassing willingness.
Did you say bodhisattvic reluctance?
Yes, occasional moments.
Moments of bodhisattvic reluctance are not separate from great awakening.
And great willingness, complete, utter, all-encompassing willingness in includes moments of bodhisattva reluctance because they are not dual, they are not separate, they cannot cancel each other out in any way.
Buddhas are those who have great realization of bodhisattvic reluctance.
Yes.
they're not just totally caught by it. They see it. Mm-hmm. This is bodhisattvic reluctance now. What is this all
about?
It's empty.
It's just a transitory mental state.
That arises due to infinite conditions, which we can't figure out.
Or control
as a backseat driver.
Right.
So, Dogen goes on to say, therefore, this one was a little bit hard for me. I sat with this one for a while. Therefore, seeing a thief as your child, it says here, as the sutra says, so maybe this is some quote, seeing a thief as your child, but we can, you know, get the gist of this image, right? Seeing a thief and thinking it's our own child, right? In other words, we're fooled. And so we could hear it as the thief is like dualistic consciousness, ordinary dualistic consciousness, and our own child is like our non-dual Buddha nature. That'd be one way to hear it. Or just, you know, illusory appearances as a child and true reality is the thief and true reality is the child. It might be interesting to try on like dualistic consciousness and non-dual awareness. Because I think is an easy one to mistake. We think, yes, it's just like this, it's just what I'm experiencing right now, but actually this is just dualistic consciousness. You all look like you're out there to me. This is my Buddha nature. Well, it is, but what does that mean, you know? What is the duality as it appears really duality? So anyway, therefore, seeing a thief as your child does not represent returning to delusion. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't it seem like that would be a common understanding of returning to delusion? Seeing a thief as your child sounds kind of like delusion, doesn't it? Seeing a thief as your child does not represent returning to delusion. Yeah, they could. I mean, we could say that, but I think the gist of the thief and child thing is being fooled and then probably being taken advantage of by this delusion, right, of the thief. I think if we understand the story to mean like that, then well, why does Russ not think it's strange?
Similar to what he said, and here's a Suzuki Roshi quote, something along the lines of, if someone wants to fool you, let them.
Oh, okay. Oh, there you go. Maybe that was even a commentary on his line. Right? Yeah. So that's nice. You're already a step ahead of me then. Yeah, so seeing a thief as your child is not actually returning to delusion. But I think conventionally speaking, a lot of people would see it as that's really what delusion is all about. Now, we could also hear it as we've been saying, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. But this is actually thinking that delusion is awakening. That's how I see seeing a thief as your child. Thinking that this deluded or dualistic consciousness is actually non-dual awareness.
Buddhas may not necessarily know that they are Buddhas. You start conceptualizing, oh my God,
I think that's in here too. I think that part I would apply to a later sentence in here. We could just hear this also as the returning to delusion that we're talking about here is not just what we usually think of as delusion, right? Here we're talking about a greatly awakened one returning to delusion, right? That's a little different kind of delusion, returning to delusion. That's like this willingness to be fooled and to come back, to live in a kind of world of a dream world, and be fooled, you know, that's the kind of returning to delusion that a greatly awakened one does, right? So that's one way we could hear, I think, Dogen saying, seeing a thief as your child does not mean returning to delusion. Seeing your child as a thief also does not mean returning to delusion. That would mean like, that's maybe a little bit like maybe what Liz was saying, seeing your true child as a thief, seeing your Buddha nature as just delusion. One way we might do that is by like calling it that or thinking that idea.
Thinking that bodhisattvic reluctance means you don't have great willingness.
Yeah, could be like that. Mm-hmm. So great awakening. So it's a kind of a four-part thing here, right? Seeing a thief as your child does not mean returning to delusion. Seeing your child as a thief does not mean returning to delusion. Great awakening is to see a thief as a thief. Returning to delusion is to see your child as your child. So, to me, great awakening is to see a thief as a thief. That's, at this point, pretty straightforward. That's like those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas, right? But the part, the line that really got me that I thought it was hard is seeing your child, or returning to delusion is to see your child as your child. That's returning to delusion.
That does seem odd.
Doesn't that? You might even say intuitively, if I were writing this, I might have said, great awakening is to see your child as your child, and great delusion, or returning to delusion, is to see a thief as a thief. Right? And still, everything's included there. Yes. Yeah, reality, Buddha nature. Yeah, that's I think what he's saying, is returning to delusion. That's I think that's the conclusion that I came to, and that's just what Liz said earlier too. This kind of cognizing, seeing your child as a child, and adding an extra thought to that is returning to delusion. I think that was my conclusion. And maybe he doesn't use the word ken in here, as in kensho, but we know that Dogen really didn't like this, like seeing something, because it's a little bit like that. You're like, I see it. And so like seeing your child as your child is maybe a little bit extra. That could be an implication of this too. And that's what we call returning to delusion.
So how do we see that fourth one as the bundling of delusion and what many thoughts does?
Could it be that all four of these relationships of thief and child are together the bundle? Maybe you need all four sentences.
Within the music of great religion.
So you're talking about just the last sentence here? The seeing the child as a child?
Yeah.
Is kind of, how is the getting angry part in there?
Well, I heard you say that it's delusion. I went there myself. It's delusion to say that's enlightenment.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But there's someone with great awakening who says that. How is that the bundling of,
oh,
of enlightened mind with conviction?
Are you saying that even when we say that, it's still part of great awakening?
I wasn't saying that. That's the solution.
Yeah, right. So there's nothing excluded, right? So even saying, I alone and the world honor one, I got it. Even that's an expression of great awakening, right? From this deep, there's nothing that isn't. And like, I am so far from it, I will never like, I've come anywhere close to great awakening, and like, I'm just a heap of eternal delusion. That's also great awakening in a sense. And to say it doesn't really defile it, but to say it seems to defile it in either direction, to say, I got it or I don't got it, or Buddha nature, a dog has Buddha nature, a dog doesn't have it. If anything seems to defile reality, it's concepts in Zen, right? And yet, ultimately speaking, what are concepts, right? Those who have great realization of concepts are Buddhas. Is it bundled enough?
Yeah.
Yes.
From a strictly cognizing vantage point, it seems to me that this conversation and the conclusion that we've just kind of jointly all reached by consensus, it seemed like, feels like a little taste of liberation. Because even if you're only operating in delusion, you have no thought of enlightenment. But you kind of wish you did, and you're suffering for the lack of it. Just knowing that even your suffering for the lack of it is absolutely, in and of itself, daigo.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, then there's just nothing to worry about.
And actually, once we start hearing about this enlightenment business, I think that's when we really start to suffer. There's people who never got into this Zen thing. They what a relief. They can bypass a lot of suffering. What is it like? I found this poem by by Ikkyu Zenji. I remember we were talking about those born knowing and so on. Ikkyu says, even Linji's disciples don't know. So many ordinary people do know, but they don't know they know. Walking to work, talking to themselves. Even Linji's disciples don't know, but they're struggling to know. Get the story. So many ordinary people do know, but they don't know that they know. Walking to work, talking to themselves. So the other day, Russ said something like, we're talking about this equality of samsara and nirvana, of delusion and awakening, and she said something like, I can see how they sound really similar, but I think Dogen's saying, isn't there like a bit of a of a difference? Or isn't there bits of something there with awakening? Is that what you said?
It was about the difference between born knowing and cultivating deep and bodhicitta.
Okay.
Inspired.
Yes, yes.
Aspiration for knowing.
And what did you say about a bit?
A tiny bit. It seemed like Dogen was not speaking of, but kind of pointing at a tiny bit of distinction between those two things.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's what, and I said, Dogen, I think, says something similar to this later. So here's where he says, adding a bit where there is already a lot is great awakening. Reducing a bit where there is just a little is returning to delusion. So, adding a bit where there's already a lot, which we could hear as already a lot means there's already a lot of awakening, like infinite. But adding a bit could be like a bit of intention. It could be a bit of practice and verification to what already doesn't need practice and verification. But that bit is adding a bit where there's already a lot is great awakening. Reducing a bit where there's only a little is returning to delusion. So, where there's, we could say, if we look at returning to delusion in the positive sense of the bodhisattva vow of just engaging in the world, we could say, where there's just a little means like, there's no enlightenment here. I'm just an ordinary person trying to help people. And reducing a bit could be like the idea that you're just an ordinary person. You know, some idea that you're adding on to ordinariness. You're reducing just a little bit where there's already very little. That's returning to delusion. If we hear returning to delusion in the positive sense, then there's already not very, already what we mean by delusion, normal delusion is like there's not very much enlightenment here. This is just very, like, it's a painful, samsaric life. But returning to delusion in this bodhisattva way is like reducing a bit of this samsara. Reducing our extra story of like, I guess I'll never be enlightened in this life. That thought maybe kind of hinders our bodhisattva work. Maybe we're to hear it, but Dogen just, you know, he won't stop. Adding a bit where there's a lot is great awakening. Reducing a bit where there's little is returning to delusion.
Being born knowing.
Being born knowing. Mm-hmm. Or the willingness to live in.
With a vow.
Yeah. When we first talked about that, this is the season, of course, for redemption.
Redemption.
Yeah, Christ being born, taking on body. Redeem.
Yes.
And there's no such word as redemption in Buddhism.
What is the meaning of redemption?
To transform that which seems ordinary to its true state.
Maybe
transformation is the equivocation there.
And also, doesn't redemption imply relieving the suffering also?
Well, it's all part of
it. Yeah, that would be part of the transformation. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, what about salvation in Buddhism? We vow to save all beings. Really means I mean, the Diamond Sutra may be the first place where this is really, this Bodhisattva vow really gets brought up and kind of defined, I think, where the Buddha says, what is a Bodhisattva? They should see all these sentient beings and numerous realms of sentient beings born from wombs, born from eggs, born from moisture, born miraculously. All types of born sentient beings. I vow to carry them all to complete nirvana with no remainder at all. And yet, the Bodhisattva in that vow sees that there are no beings at the same time. So it's interesting, I think, that the saving is actually not just kind of like kind of helping them in ordinary ways might involve that, but the real salvation is bringing them all to the unborn. So, and it's seeing that they, the ones that we're bringing to the unborn, were not really born either. I don't know if that's redemption. Maybe related. Yeah, maybe differences. But we could say salvation. So redeem is to
see that something is imperfect, or it's just in that potential or in the defilement. And that has to be purified. I think it's more like purification.
Take away the sins of the world.
I'm sorry, still.
Take away the sins of the world.
I think that's very similar. Redeeming it. Whereas it's empty. I mean, there really isn't.
Well, isn't that kind of like the saving all these born beings from the illusion of birth, which is kind of the Bodhisattva vow. Similar anyway. Ziggy has, probably has a comment. Doesn't sound so different to me.
Well, forgiveness is a part of that redemption. And these are lots of steps in here, but clearly there's this... I wish we could get another... Maybe we can, another conversation with you and Father Cyprian. You know, this... I think there are a lot of... it's language, you know, but there's a complete... meeting that is happening, I think, in the West and the East, and has been for a long time, you know, and I think that we're in a really interesting time as Buddhism is moving into the West in such a beautiful way, and Christianity is dying in the, you know, in Europe and in the Americas, but is growing hugely in Africa and Asia. We don't know what's happening in China, but there's a big underground church in China. So there's a
beautiful big circle around the earth.
And so I think there's a great awakening
wonderful to appreciate the resonances between all these traditions.
There's a lot of suffering going on.
Mm-hmm. And we keep practicing, we chanted the other day, the Fukan Zazengi, and Dogen says, need I mention the Buddha, who was possessed of inborn knowledge? So that's the same character, Shochi. Need I mention the Buddha, who was born knowing? The influence of his 6 years of upright sitting is noticeable still. So, adding a little bit to what's a lot. Yes, yes.
the defilement part, we talk about defilements too, but like all the phenomena, the defilements are part of the R and B.
Yes.
And so they're part of the
D. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Different languaging.
Mm-hmm. You say it's nothing?
Well, you and Ziggy should have a debate later.
Are they emptying themselves? To be uncrossed. And yes, you have a debate somewhere. This is not a debate. That's not a debate.
A conversation.
Yeah, well, it's so much in the air right now. And will be more so. That I couldn't help but bring my mind
straight. Yeah. Yeah. It's all related. This is our Christmas session. We're celebrating Christ's great birth these days.
Ancient masters and current ones.
Wait, I have one last word on this. That may not be the last word, but today is the feast of the Immaculate Conception, which people confuse as that, oh, somehow Jesus was conceived without sex. Okay, well, that's not what it is. It's that Mary, who bore Jesus, was born without sin, without any defilement. And so I think it's sort of interesting, this the whole thing about birth and its continuing kind of thing. So I just thought I'd toss that in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the Buddha.
I'm coming from 16 years of Catholic education. Not outside.
Hark, the herald angels sing. The devas come and dance about the zendo, and the devas and the angels dancing together, laughing at the bodhisattva assembly, trying to make heads or tails out of all this stuff. Or wings.
I love Christmas.
Isn't that when Christ sat under the Christmas tree? Well, you've got to have a tree in the center of all these traditions too, where the flowers all drop off and never can return. Okay, enough of this. Better have some lunch to ground us.
What more is going to be banging on the door?
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.